and welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities,
where we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
As always, it is Nick Cameron of Glacially Musical, and I am joined by Duncan Evans of Moonlow, Duncan Evans Music, and now Waxworm. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm all right. The sun is shining here in Leeds, so I'm going to go for a walk after this. We're getting longer evenings, and it's going to be even longer from tomorrow because the clocks go forward tonight. I'm drinking turmeric tea from my Hunter S. Thompson mug, and I've just listened to the record that we're going to talk about. But before we do, who was that we just listened to, Nick? It sounded like what I would call power pop.
That was Ace Frehley. How did it sound? Did it sound good?
Yeah, I mean, it sounded fine. You know, it sounded like quite catchy. Like I say, I thought it might be in the early 80s power pop category. Which
late 80s.
That was what he was going for, right? Okay, fair enough.
This was late 80s. This actually was an album that was from Ace Frehley's Trouble Walking, his third solo record before falling into bankruptcy and addiction and gambling addiction and all kinds of wonderful fun stuff that was semi-solved by the Kiss reunion tour. They had completely revamped. It was Frehley's Comet, then it became just solo, and they changed the band up a little bit. And it was had one pressing because it was released in 1989. So it's that weird era where they're still pressing vinyl and still selling it, but not really here.
And that was when vinyl, the quality of the actual physical pressings was going down, wasn't it? They were recycling old unsold records to make new ones, making them thinner and thinner and thinner, so the sound quality was worse. Yeah,
correct. But being as this is a Kiss related album, it's got a double collectability to it because Kiss fans, unlike myself, Kiss fans who aren't like me, truly believe that anything that anybody in that band has ever touched is going to become a collectible thing. So the value of this had gotten up to $75-$80 a pressing, a copy, so I believed I'd never find one, but I actually found one for $30, which is a little pricey for an album I don't absolutely love. But I thought, you know what, if I don't buy this, I'm going to regret it. So I picked it up. It showed up in the mail the last few days. But, here in St. Louis, everything is going well. I am proud to say, and hopefully everybody who follows me on social media will already know this, but as we are recording this on Saturday morning, I got my COVID vaccine 2 days ago.
Yeah, that's really good. So you guys have, it's the same, I think, where you have two doses, but you see, so you've had the first.
Oh, no. We have three different vaccines now. And the third vaccine is by a drug maker called Johnson & Johnson, and it's a one shot.
Oh, wow. So you are completely vaccinated.
I'm done doing everything. It takes 2 weeks for it to reach full efficacy. So by the time this comes out, I will actually have already done this, but I am so proud to say that my best friend also is fully vaccinated as of now. He had the two-shot system. And I mean, this is a friend of mine and we have been friends for over 20 years. I mean, the vast majority of my life, he has been by my side in some way or another. He actually is the one that gave me this shirt. This is from
Mighty
a taco,
taco
place. It's from a restaurant in Buffalo where he lived for a time. And we already have plans for him to come over and we are going to grill up some steaks and we're going to listen to records and we're going to drink beer and we're going to play 25-year-old video games that we've always played. And I am so, he'll be able to be in my house.
Sounds great, man. Yeah, sounds great. And hopefully, hopefully it won't be too long for me. I think it might be a couple of months, but let's just see how it goes. I think over 50% of the population in the UK have now had one shot at least in the two-shot system. So we're getting there. They're going down the age groups.
Yeah, I got mine like surprisingly early because at this point in time, I'm not even, eligible. I'm not eligible yet. But they have these mass vaccination events here in the States. So what I've been doing is, even though I know I'm not eligible, I've been putting in for those lists in the hopes that they don't get enough respondents.
Yeah, because of course the vaccine has to be used within a certain amount of time, doesn't it? So if it doesn't get used and then they have spare. Yeah, absolutely.
So I was hoping that they just wouldn't have enough people, so they would start taking other people, and that's just what happened to me. That's all. I mean, I don't know for sure, but that's what I assume. I also learned that if you don't have an appointment at a mass event, show up at the end because they might have leftovers.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely.
I learned that yesterday from, I saw that from a nurse on Twitter, but I think I don't want to talk about the the pandemic anymore. I've got good pandemic news and I'm moving on.
Sure. Let's do that.
Here in St. Louis, everything is going well. Like I said, sun is shining. We're going to go run some errands. My daughter starts playing hockey again on Tuesday. Is her first day of spring hockey. So we're going to get her skates sharpened, her brand new skates sharpened today. Brand new to us. Of course, we buy used. I'm not buying her new equipment until she stops growing an inch every 3 weeks. But we're doing that. We're going to get pizza. As the day we record this is the National Women's Hockey League Cup Final. So we're going to watch that and eat some pizza.
Cool.
And in the meantime. And
pizza sounds good, man. Yeah. Great.
Good day. Good. It's going to be a good day. And in the meantime, we are talking about what today?
Okay. So this is almost universally considered to be the worst Black Sabbath album of all time. This is 1995's Forbidden.
I have seen people who genuinely love this record.
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, and we'll talk about this in a minute. I mean, you know, once you set it up to be the worst anything of all time, it's quite hard to live up to that in the same way that saying something's the best whatever of all time. It's then very quite true. Hard to live up to that. So, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of... I don't know, smaller up and coming local bands that you might see at a small show when those things exist again. And that would probably, they would probably not be doing music quite as good as this. You know, this is clearly a professional band playing music at a professional standard. It's just, you know, people don't consider it to be anywhere near what a Black Sabbath album should be. And we'll see whether we agreed about that shortly, but I just wanted to read a couple of little quotes. So
real quick, before you get to that, I wanted to jump on your point about, you know, it being the worst. When you hear something is the worst or the best, it either makes you sympathetic or critical.
Yeah.
Totally. And I will tell you before we get going, I listened to this with a sympathetic ear. I was trying, because, you know, that's my thing, is I like the weirder stuff. And I was trying to find the stuff to hold on to. That's just me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I certainly didn't go into this thinking, haha, let's trash it. At the same time, I was kind of looking forward to just hearing, like, what is so bad about this? Is it so bad? You know, people have given it 1 star and 1.5 star out of 5. So there's a couple of things here. So both Tony Martin and Tony Iommi, Tony Martin being the singer and Iommi being, of course, the only original member, the only constant Black Sabbath member, the guitar player. Both of those guys have said they don't like it very much. So there's a review quote here that says, with boring songs, awful production, with uninspired performances, this is easily avoidable for all but the most enthusiastic fans, and said it was a sad state of affairs. And there's another quote that says, from a different review by Blender magazine, that says, Forbidden was an embarrassment, the band's worst album. Now, interestingly, Tony Martin, this is his take on it. He says it was a filler album. This is a quote. He says it was a filler album that got the band out of the label deal, rid of the singer, meaning him, and into the reunion, meaning the reunion with Ozzy, which happened probably a year or two afterwards. And then he says he wasn't privy to that information at the time. But of course, Iommi was at that stage already in negotiations with probably Sharon and Ozzy. And
Wait. So this is our second album recorded in 1995, where an iconic band was in negotiations to reunite without... But the difference was this one... Tony didn't tell the rest of the band, whereas with Kiss, everybody knew.
That sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds
same
about
year.
Right.
It's even the same year.
Yep. Yeah, totally.
That is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So it is the last one before the reunion of the classic lineup, or the Aussie lineup. You know, there was a few issues with whether they had the drummer Bill Ward in or not at different stages. But anyway, and it's produced interestingly, perhaps strangely, by early singing from Body Count.
Waiting for that to come up. That I like Body Count. I'm not I'm not an Uber fan. I remember buying or semi-owning or whatever their first album back in the day, and it, if it were any other band doing, if any other band doing that first record, it probably would have gotten passed over, but it having the Ice-T connection, because it was clearly a first attempt by a brand new band. There were some issues there, but it's still a pretty good record. I have it. I bought a reissue on vinyl, and I have their latest Carnivore. And you know, I've been keeping up with them. I'm not, like I said, not an Uber fan, but I do enjoy Body Count. Having Ernie C at this time, though, Body Count was a huge kind of force in the underground.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is not long after the whole Cop Killer fiasco and all that. So having this would have been a good publicity boost for the band. Didn't work because I never heard of this album until the 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, the there's a few issues here. I mean, the album cover, when you look at the album cover, and people can Google it, I've just found a high res.
Real quick, here's an easy it looks like the lady, not the the drawings that Pusshead did for Injustice for All. Picture those, but in bright primary colors, and then make them the Grim Reaper rather than Lady Justice. And that's what this album cover looks like.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know if you have them in the US, but there's a guy called Terry Pratchett who wrote a series called the Discworld novels.
Yeah.
Right, okay. It's kind of like the cover of a Discworld novel, but slightly more cartoony. But the thing Discworld is, it's fantasy, but it's also humor. It's meant to be a little bit silly and...
If it was meant to be a little bit silly, they screwed up because it's a lot silly.
Yeah, this is the thing. Discworld is meant to be a bit silly and humorous and satirical.
No, I mean the cover was supposed to be a lot silly.
This cover is like, it's like that, but sillier, but it's for a band like Black Sabbath who
is not like, silly.
They're kind, yeah, exactly. A serious band. Now, okay, some of the lyrical things might occasionally, I don't know that they necessarily mean all the devils and demons stuff they're singing about, but they sing about it with conviction. It's meant
their
to be.
Their lyrics are not silly. They're fantastical.
Yeah, totally.
It's like watching a movie. You know, bands like Black Sabbath and Deicide and Slayer, for me, those bands were never about giving the tacit approval of what they sang about, rather than just telling, they're just telling a story.
Yeah, for sure. But this makes it look like a comedy children's story. Like you've got this strange fish thing with funny, quirky eyes and a grin on its face. And the Grim Reaper just looks like, the Grim Reaper isn't scary. The Grim Reaper is just like a friendly figure, a friendly cartoon character. So right from the start, you think, okay, this isn't a great album cover. This doesn't sit up there with the classic Sabbath.
Having said that, it doesn't look like a Sabbath cover.
No, it doesn't. I was just going to say, it's not as though they can't do humor sometimes in a certain way. With Heaven and Hell, you've got the nuns smoking cigarettes type of cover, and that works because it's just a certain type of slightly dark, subtle humor. But
you found that funny?
Just silly.
I thought that was a dichotomy photo or dichotomy painting. I loved that cover.
Okay. I certainly think there's a. I think it's meant to be kind of amusing in a sort of satirical, dark way. You've got I've just looked at the cover.
Angels
playing cards and smoking cigarettes.
Love that cover.
So you've got the heaven and the hell all in one right there. I think that's definitely a bit.
We can disagree on that concept. That's fine.
But anyway, so yeah. It's kind of bad, the album cover.
Terrible. It's not kind of bad. I know you're English and far more polite than us Americans. I will say it is truly awful. I look at that cover and it looks like a high school kid trying to recreate a Metallica cover. There's no good use of color. When I brought up the point that it's in primary colors, and it is. There's no shading. There's no light and dark. It's just this reasonably good drawing colored in stupidly. And it just, if they had used better colors, maybe a more real, what made the Heaven and Hell paint, because Black Sabbath typically uses photos for their covers. What made Heaven and Hell a great cover? What made,
Mob Rules?
Not Mob Rules. What made Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath a great cover? Again, those are paintings.
Oh, yeah.
They're not, you know, they're not cartoony paintings.
Sure, sure.
There's a lot of, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, that cover is basically just red, black, and white. Mm-hmm. But it's lots of shades. Here, there's no shades.
Mm.
It just looks terrible. And
yeah.
The other terrible black, this actually is the other album cover considered to be terrible, is also a painting.
Sure. Which one's
Born
that?
Again.
Oh, no, it's not a painting. It's from it's got some inks added to it, but it's actually from a scan. It's literally from a scan of an unborn baby in the womb.
This okay, well, why, you know, it looks
why
like
it was considered to be especially tasteless as well.
Okay. So you know what? Go. Maybe it's a photo, but you know what? It's a photo made to look like a painting, so it's a painting.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. It counts.
We'll go with that. So, I'm ready to get into the track by track if you are.
Sure.
Okay.
Again, I should have mentioned this before we started recording, but you know, I'm very, very, you know, put together and professional. My copy that I listened to was YouTube. It was just a big blobby thing because I was running out of time. So I couldn't listen to a playlist because it would have so many commercials and all that kind of business. So I'm going to need you to list off the titles.
Okay. So track one is The Illusion of Power.
Now, I could have guessed the title of that one based on the chorus. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect Ice-T to show up in the first track. I knew Ice-T was on this album. I didn't know when. I had never heard it. I'm presuming this was also a single. But for this one, it's got a great intro. The bass riffs are amazing. And this song is... The intro to this song really gives me hope. And, you know, it's got... But then the vocals kick in.
Yeah.
And that's when this song goes from heaven to hell, as Ronnie James Dio would put it.
But, well done.
But far better than what I just did. And Tony Martin is singing double time. So you've got this slow, sludgy, Sabbath-y riff. You've got the wah-wah pedal going on the bass. This sounded like classic Sabbath until Tony Martin sticks his face in it and just ruins it. And
yeah.
Even Ice-T couldn't save this. And Ice-T sounded like crap on this track too. And I love Ice-T.
The strange thing was, I genuinely, when it all started, it's got jangly atmospheric guitars. Then it kicks into a really cool load of slow Sabbath-y riffs. And you think, yeah, this is actually great. But then Tony Martin didn't sound like I've heard him sound before. Now, granted, I've probably not heard his vocals on anything sort of post about 10 years before this, so I would have heard him on the TYR album, which was, I don't know, late 80s, and this is probably 6-7 years later or something. So I don't know whether he just developed his style or whether he was being produced maybe by Ernie C to sing in a certain way, but it felt like he wasn't rapping, but like you say, he was doing this faster, more kind of aggressive style. Doesn't sound like
I didn't Dio even consider anymore. The Ernie C connection there, but Ernie C's a metal guy, so I wouldn't, maybe he was trying to get thrashier.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's another track later on where I think they do get a bit thrashier. But yeah, I actually wasn't sure whether it was Ice-T, because I knew Ice-T was on this track. I wasn't sure whether it was Ice-T trying to do a singing voice like a Black Sabbath singer. And then, of course, when Ice-T actually came in just doing his normal rap, I thought, okay, right, now I get it. That was Tony Martin. But it didn't really... Tony Martin often sounds like Dio, just not quite as good, and this didn't really sound like Dio.
See, Tony Martin, and I'm gonna say this one time just to get it out of the way, because if I don't, I'm gonna say it 1,000 times. Tony Martin is probably the perfect singer to bridge the gap between Dio and Ozzy, because he can sing kind of like Ozzy and he can sing kind of like Dio, and there are times when he does a pretty convincing Dio, and he does it quite a bit on this album.
Yeah, there are definitely a few times, but not really on this
first not on track. This track.
So,
no.
Yeah, look, I thought the chorus was a bit cheesy, which is going to be a running theme that I'm going to come back to. I thought it was not a terrible song. I thought there's some great riffs in it, but I thought it kind of sounds like a newer band have gone, let's write some Black Sabbath riffs. Cool. And then they're trying to put the other pieces together to sound like Black Sabbath, and it doesn't quite work. Like a band imitating Sabbath, but they can only do part of it properly, which...
Sorry about that. I had to pause Duncan, and I couldn't get a good signal to him that I had to pause him. So you were saying, it sounded like a band trying to sound like Sabbath.
Yeah, it's like a band that have tried, they've got part of it right, and then they can't quite get the other bits right. But this actually is Sabbath. So given that this is Sabbath, and it sounds like a band trying to partially successfully imitate Sabbath, that's not so great.
Yeah, what I would say... on this track, and we always, it seems like our first impressions of an album are always the most lasting, and it's the ones that we typically bang on about for quite a while, and here we are still doing that. Mm-hmm. But with this track, at the beginning, until Tony Martin kicked in, it sounded like classic Sabbath to me. If you take Tony Martin out of this equation, and Ice-T, sorry Ice, and you put Ronnie James Dio or Ozzy Osbourne, maybe even Glenn Hughes, singing on top of this and writing the lyrics, this is a classic song.
It certainly could have been, but it just wasn't quite. And yeah, it is largely the vocals that were the issue there.
That was my issue. Man.
So track two, Get a Grip. What did you make of this one?
This was it, same thing. And this is going to be my running theme. It starts off with some amazing riffing. And I might say something a little bit blasphemous right now, but some of the riffs on this album were better than what were on Dehumanizer. Tony Iommi, I think largely on this record, plays an inspired guitar. His solos. I mean, playing that classic Black Sabbath. This is the album they were trying to make when they did Headless Cross, because they were trying to make that classic Black Sabbath musically, not vocally. And you know, the bass on this is good. The bass player figured out how to play in that geezer style. And that's what I think has been missing out of the albums without Geezer. Geezer he's Black Sabbath's Steve Harris. Mm-hmm. Lyricist, amazing bass riffs to play in harmony with the guitar, so they only need one guitar player. And when you lose that, it's not Sabbath in terms of sound.
Yes. Yes.
Martin does sound good on this one. You know, I liked this song. I don't have a whole lot of thought specifically on it, but maybe it's because it came right after the double time Tony Martin, which that is probably the worst performance I've ever heard by that man.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's some great guitar licks and great guitar solo, really cool. Some cool riffs. The chorus, again, cheesy chorus, cheesy 80s chorus. And this is 1995. Not great.
A lot of gang vocals in the choruses.
It feels as well like they're going for almost a bit of post-grunge. Like, and when this is 1995, so it was the era for post-grunge, and almost getting into slightly new metal-ish in places, which doesn't sit too well with me. So look, it's fine. It's okay. It's not great. A bit cheesy in the choruses. It doesn't set my world on fire, but not absolutely terrible. The solos, great. Just isolate the 3 minutes or 2 minutes or whatever it is of soloing and lead guitar. Great. I'll listen to that. No problem.
I think if they took this album and just had a different singer sing on top of it, I would love every song.
Okay, I would say it's maybe there are a few more issues with it than that for me, but that would certainly be a big help.
We're allowed to disagree.
Yeah. So track three, Can't Get Close Enough.
Actually, I take that back because I had forgotten how we get on the back half. So no, I take that back.
Okay. So Can't Get Close Enough, track three.
That's the name of the. Oh my god, that is a terrible title.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is kind of a rock ballad, or it starts off rock ballad-ish. Martin sounds like Dio again. He's really doing his kind of somber, subdued Dio voice. And it kicks in and we get a nice riff. We get a really cool mid-paced riff, which really reminded me of Dio era Sabbath, like Children of the Sea or something. Not quite as strong as that, but getting towards it. and a pretty cool solo. And you know what? It's fine. It doesn't set my world on fire. And I think that is the, again, it's the vocals and the vocal melodies, maybe, that just aren't quite there. But yeah, you know,
exactly.
It's all and right. It's all
with,
right.
With this one, this is where, see, I took something different away from this song than you did. Mm-hmm. This one didn't harken back. I mean, lyrically, and I wasn't paying too close attention because I never do in terms of lyrics, but lyrically, it harkened back a little bit to the Heaven and Hell kind of vocal style, not vocal, but lyrical style, the way, and, but it's that slow rock ballad. Where have we heard Tony Iommi playing a slow rock ballad before?
Oh, I don't know. Probably somewhere on Seventh Star.
Correct.
Yeah.
I still believe in love.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
So this is where, for me on this album, it starts hearkening back a little bit to Seventh Star.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that is a good point.
And I don't know that that's ever the right choice to make.
It's not. Especially not for Black Sabbath, because that was never meant to be a Sabbath album. And
correct.
It doesn't sound like a Sabbath album for the most part.
So that's where I started. This was the first time, and it's only the third track, so I mean, it's not like we're that deep in. It wasn't a bad track, and I put on there as well that there's some great Tony Iommi lead guitar work, and definitely. Listening to Tony Iommi play is one of the absolute joys and treasures of heavy metal. And I will fight anybody who says different. By fight, I mean say you're wrong and run away.
I like it.
And this song does have a lot of that kind of inspired Tony Iommi playing. When you read the parts about saying uninspired performances and this and that, I don't see that. I mean, I think everybody really, there's no song where I would say that somebody's not trying. Everybody's going hard and trying to be convincing. And
that's true, but I think the writing is where it's lacking. I think it's a bit hastily thrown together. And they've said that.
Lyrically and vocally, yes, it is definitely hastily thrown together. And it sounds a lot like, you know, they didn't work out the vocals as much as they said, here are the lyrics. You go to town.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, so let's go to Shaking Off the Chains, which is track 4. What did you make of this one?
That is the first time I've heard the song title, and I'm going to say these titles are not getting better. I tried to give this song a chance, and at this point in time in the record, I'm noticing a lot of trends coming up that I don't like, and this song is just terrible.
I was going to say, I think this is one of the worst moments of the album. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It starts with a sort of groovy riff in 7/8 time. Interesting.
I had in my notes, there's a little goodness. It starts off with a little goodness on guitar and then it just falls apart.
Yeah. Then it almost tries to go thrash metal or something and it just doesn't work. It's like they're trying to be really frantic. In fact, I'll tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of when Metallica did what's it called? Saint Anger. And when there's that song Frantic, and it just feels really forced. And they're like, frantic, tick, 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 tock, and all that. And it just, I don't know, it just doesn't work, especially when you see how they wrote it on that film, Some Kind of Monster.
This feels like that. Let's not bring up Saint Anger ever again. Okay,
yeah, thank you. But I can just feel that. I can just feel that they might have written this in a similar way. Like, hey, you know, let's try and do some, what's popular at the moment? There's this thing, thrash metal. Okay, let's try and do that. And you can just kind of see them trying to do it and it's not really getting there. It's not hitting the mark, but they're a bit out of touch with maybe those newer metal trends and they, you know, they stick it on.
I will say this is around the time where Iommi and Hetfield were like publicly seen together and close friends and they did press together. So
that makes a lot of sense. It's almost like, right, yeah, I've been hanging out with Hetfield. I've been listening to Metallica. Here's our take on Metallica. And then Tony Martin, whose voice does not suit that at all, go and sing it. Uh-oh, doesn't work.
And right now we are, I've been making the point that the middle of the album is always where you put your bad songs.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's exactly what we've gotten into right now, is we are into the mushy middle of this record.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that too much. So track five, I Won't Cry For You.
Oh my God, that is they just get worse.
Yeah, it starts with, I've described it as terrible synth ballad cheese nonsense. It's basically just an awful keyboard part, that the sort of part that, you know, when you're growing up, sometimes, I don't know if you went through this phase, but certainly I did. When you're very young getting into music, keyboards seemed like a cool thing. Then
Van Halen 1984 was the first time I heard them. And oh my God, you've nailed it. You have found the future.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you get a bit older, somehow keyboards just seemed really uncool. And you wanted to listen to rock music that was a little bit rawer, and keyboards just seemed awful and cheesy and stupid, and you just didn't want to hear them. This is the exact type of keyboard part to play someone if you want to convince them of that argument, that keyboards should not be in rock music, which I don't agree with that argument at all, by the way. I think keyboards can be absolutely great synths in all sorts of music, including rock. But this is terrible. It's just the archetypal, awful synth nonsense, cheesy, horrible sound. It's not good. Very 80s. It's a rock ballad. You've got some okay riffs, but I think it's pretty weak. I don't know what you made of this one.
Well, I'll tell you. For me, this is another, you know, another mellow Tony Martin ballad. And I think I'm on record with saying I'm not a big fan of the mellow Tony Martin ballads.
Mm.
Vocally, he goes into his low rent Dio.
Yes, he does.
He can do Dio better screaming than he can do singing.
Mm.
And, you know, it's low rent Dio. It's another terrible ballad. And like I said, we're just into the mushy middle. And I just, at this point in time, I'm looking at the clock going, my God, how much of this record is left?
Yeah. So the answer is we're halfway. So yeah. Track six, which presumably would be side two, I guess, start of side two, Guilty as Hell. What did you get for this one?
Guilty, oh my Lord. I'm half tempted to ask you to stop reading off the titles, even though I asked you to do so. It starts off with a great riff. You know, we're starting off side two, because this was released on vinyl, and I think it costs about $300 if you can actually find a copy of it.
Wow.
You know, I'm listening to the song and I'm kind of like live tweeting it. It's, you know, so far so good, but at this point in the record, because, you know, after the intro, the post intro riff, and it's sounding good. It's sounding like Sabbath. It's sounding big and dark, but I'm just so worried that this song is going to go into the crapper.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it did. It, once it got to the chorus, Tony Martin goes into his Ozzy Wales, and he's not good at Ozzy Wales. He can get that kind of, you know, that Ozzy sound where he's almost in key, almost hitting notes, that thing. But nobody can wail like Ozzy could. I mean, that's just kind of like nobody can wail like Rob Halford could. And, you know, it gets to the high-pitched chorus, and it just goes downhill, and I just kind of went back to drinking my tea. And I want to say my wife got me an Edgar Allan Poe coffee mug, which has little Poe heads all over it, and they're called polka dots. So I was drinking my tea out of that today.
I like it. Yeah, just as an aside, I've just found a copy of the record, which is £306.70. It seems to be some sort of dollars, but they're not US dollars, and it's 2,420. I don't know where, but anyway, 306 pesos. Okay, that's pesos. It says dollars. So £306.70. So, wow.
About, yes, 450 bucks.
Crazy. They're crazy. Yeah, not worth it.
When people ask me about, like, a friend of mine a couple of years ago said, I know you like records. My father has this huge collection, and you can come over and take anything you want. And as I'm going through them, I mean, there wasn't much there that I was interested in. It was mostly stuff before 1965. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's like, yeah, my boyfriend's like, you shouldn't give it to him. This might be valuable. And I'm like, no. Nothing from this time frame is valuable unless you have like a first pressing of the Beatles or something.
Yeah.
The stuff that's really, really valuable in 2020 are the things that were pressed in the 90s, because there's not that, there's so few of them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think this was even released in the States on vinyl, because nobody liked vinyl in the States at that time. Sure. I don't remember, in terms of not counting the used stores that I go to and mention frequently, I don't recall seeing a brand new one. I saw one. Now that I think about it, I can remember seeing one new record in the entirety of the 90s that wasn't at Hot Topic. That was at like an actual record store.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wish I would have bought it. Now I didn't, because I thought it was stupid. I made poor choices.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, man. So look, Guilty as Hell. Yeah, you're right. It started with some okay riffs and then it went wrong. It went cheesy 80s. I thought the chorus was actually not too bad, but nah, just not great. Just not a brilliant song. And I just, that's it. That's all I've got to say on it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm not the musician with the ear that you are, but it felt like that was one of those choruses where they go from a minor key into a major key in order to make it bigger. Am I right on that? Or is it just, I know they went up.
Can't remember. I mean,
okay. If you can't remember, I'm not going to ask you to try.
Yeah, sure. So after that, we get the one which might describe how some of us were feeling about the album by this stage, which is Sick and Tired, track 7.
Oh my. Actually, oh, okay, that's funny. Can I go first?
Yeah.
Okay. I said that, you know, I'd have no problems with this album apart from the vocals. I take that back. And here's where I really noticed something. Sick and Tired is a perfect title for this, because for my notes, it starts off so well. And that's, you know, a common theme. And it just goes bloop. And but what I noticed was this is like the third or fourth song where they're trying to recreate that amazing track at the end of Seventh Star. Do you remember that one?
Sort of.
That really, really good blues track they did.
Yeah, I do remember that one. Yeah, I do.
What I should have done was I should have Googled the name or looked at the back of my cover rather than having to check this on my phone. But I didn't prepare. That song was the last song. It was like 7 minutes long. It was it wasn't the last song. It was Heart Like a Wheel, I think is what it was.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, I've got that here. Yeah, I think that's right.
Just an amazing song. And it really, and that song makes Seventh Star worthwhile, because that song is so good.
Yeah. And
it felt like they were trying to get to that, you know, classic bluesy feel and blues, you know, 12 bar. And yeah. But they just couldn't get it. What made that song so great was Glenn Hughes.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree. I mean, yeah, look, there's some great bluesy lead guitars on this one. I've put it sounds a bit like Whitesnake. It's got that kind of feel, that hard, bluesy hard rock. Right.
That's that Black Sabbath. That's Heart Like a Wheel.
Yeah, totally.
That was bluesy Whitesnake before Whitesnake knew to do it.
Yeah, yeah. But again, it just feels hastily thrown together and it doesn't feel like Black Sabbath to me. So
completely agree with that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, man. Okay, so unless you've got anything more on that one, track 8 is Rusty Angels.
What the hell does that even mean?
I know, yeah, how can angels go rusty? I don't know. Ask Tony Martin.
I don't want to.
Now, for me, this is kind of a better song, but with a caveat. I don't think it's a brilliant song, but I think it would be pretty good if it was on a kind of later Van Halen album somewhere. It's like Van Halen. It's big 80s rock, kind of feel good stuff.
And that's the problem with this whole album, isn't it? There's a lot of 80s tropes, and we're not even like knee deep into the 90s. We're waist deep. This is coming up to our belly buttons in the 90s. And all of these things have become unfashionable, dated, out of style, and any other synonyms and analogies you can name. That's where we are. And they're like, well, let's just throw in a bunch and just see if it works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's strange. I mean, I remember 1995, and yeah, that 80s rock sort of stuff really did seem dated by then, you know.
Completely. And at this time, there were no, you know, melodic metal singers were on the skids at best.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
And nobody did gang choruses because, come on, my God.
And again, the weird thing with this one is it feels like in the chorus, they kind of go a bit grunge or almost like something like Black Hole Sun by Soundgarden, that kind of melodic, slightly more jangly guitars, clean guitars and those melodies. And, yeah, that doesn't work. Apart from that, it would work as a big 80s rock song. But you add that and it's like, what is it now? A bit grunge, a bit 80s rock. None of those things are what Sabbath are supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's hard to compare this as a Black Sabbath record, because when you listen to albums like, you know, Master of Reality and Heaven and Hell and, you know, just the debut, and then you compare it to this or Born Again or this feels like another record that should have been called something else.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely. This is not classic Sabbath at all. So then we get onto the title track, which is track 9 out of 10, Forbidden. So yeah, what did you get from this one?
It's the same song over and over at this point. They don't, you know, There's a lot of great Tony Iommi guitar work. The bass player, whose name I forget, he's doing pretty well. Cozy Powell is even throwing in some nice double bass runs and stuff like that. And it's all sounding good. And then the songs just fall to hell. It doesn't take long for them to fall apart.
Yeah, there's another horrible 80s keyboard sound over the verse that was already, as we were just saying, this wasn't even the 80s. Even in the 80s, it would have been quite horrible. But, you know,
would have not gotten them over in 1985.
Yeah, exactly.
They would have been looked at as a, you know, for the songs like this, they would have been looked at as a copycat band.
Yeah, exactly.
This would have been like Robert Plant and Shaken and Stirred.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So there's some okay riffs, but it's just generally quite forgettable for me. I was starting to find they were all blurring into one a bit. And
completely. Once we got past the first three or four, it, you know, we're getting the same harkening back to Seventh Star, the same harkens back to Headless Cross. And, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff here, but the playing and the performances are very inspired, but I think the production and the direction is very uninspired.
And the writing of some of it. So the last track then, Kiss of Death, track 10.
They're doing that Wheel song again, and that's all I got.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, clean guitar and synth intro. You got Martin sounding DOS again, but it really feels like they should have re-recorded some of those vocal parts, because he goes a bit out in places. It feels a bit strained and he misses a couple of the notes just a bit.
I can remember when I was listening to this, I remember thinking to myself, I probably have enough. I probably don't need to finish this off. Then I looked at the time and it's like, oh, it's only 98 seconds left. I guess I could maybe make it. But I'll admit I was not paying super close attention during the last couple of songs.
Sure. I mean, there's a quite good slow Sabbath riff at one point. And I think the middle eight section is actually really quite cool. I liked that. And I can't remember what they were singing now, but they were singing quite a distinctive bit, although it's obviously not distinctive enough that I've remembered it. Oh, here we go. So they're saying something like, every lie that you tell, you get closer and all this. I think that's the bit that they are singing. And that bit I really liked. I thought that was a strong section, but then it goes back into more of the same, gets a bit boring. The melodies are not memorable and it doesn't sound enough like Sabbath should. And then that's it. So I don't know, man. It's not absolutely horrendously terrible. It's not like they did Chipmunk Voices, although they did have rap on a Black Sabbath song, which is kind of strange, but For the most part, it's not like anything absolutely outrageously insane, but it's just pretty weak and melodically uninspired, and the guitar solos and a few nice riffs aren't enough to save this for me. Even if you take it as not Black Sabbath, it's like, nah, it doesn't quite know what it is. It still thinks it's the 80s, even though it's the 90s. It's a bit all over the shop and, nah, just not strong.
Completely agree. The problem I have with this album isn't Tony Iommi. The biggest problem I have, of course, is Tony Martin. And I don't hate Tony Martin. I know I sound like I'm really, you know, tearing him a new one today, but I have like two or three Tony Martin albums sitting on my shelf on vinyl. Thank you again for TYR or Tear or whatever the hell it's called. Mm-hmm. I would rather listen to Forbidden than this album, because even though Forbidden is too over the top and crazy, it knows what it is. This, interestingly enough, the next album Tony Iommi recorded after this one, it wasn't released for another 10 years, but it was his second album with Glenn Hughes.
Oh, of course, the Depth Sessions, as it became known. Is that right?
Yep, that is correct. Right. And we listened to that on an Instagram Live a couple of last year.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that he's writing a lot of these songs that harken back to the work they did together. And the next thing he does is go right back to Glenn Hughes. Yeah.
It is interesting.
Which makes perfect sense. And this album, you know, usually I would say on a lot of things we've done where I would say the pieces are there, they just hadn't gotten them put together in the right order. Yeah. They have a lot of pieces here that don't fit that they put in there anyway.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. There's a lot of pieces that don't fit. And then even the ones that do, aside from some great riffs, there are a few great riffs, not
a lot of great riffs. I will say it. Tony Iommi is, as he should have been, the absolute star and gem of this album. He played an amazing record.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think...
He didn't write an amazing record.
There is best riffs ever on average, but I think there's probably three or four or five riffs that are up there with his best.
Agreed. And some of the solos, he's got a great modern tone, which I love that Iommi sound where he's got the pinched harmonics going. He's got that brittle... almost, and this is going to be blasphemy, a little black metal-y tinniness to it. Loved it. That was my whole jump in. I'm done.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that's kind of it for me. So I guess we just need to talk about whether we spin it or bin it for this one. And for me... I'm going to say bin it, man. I don't think those guitar solos and five or six great riffs, I don't think they're enough to save this album. I think it's not so bad it's good, if you see what I mean. I almost think it would be, you know.
It's just a little bit bad.
Yeah, but it's a little bit bad all the way through.
Correct. I think there's one song that I liked all the way through, the second track, which I don't know the name of.
Get a grip.
That is the only song I liked all the way through on this whole album. The rest of it, there were great parts and bad, and then a lot of bad parts. And if you can't write two complete songs, then no, you shouldn't be writing a record. I would make the argument that they should have hired somebody to produce Black Sabbath who had been a longtime producer rather than someone like Ernie C, who had only been in the public eye for 3 years as a performer, not as a producer.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think when you really dig into it, I think Tony Martin really nailed up what this album is. It's a filler. It's let's get this done so we can get moving back to where we're supposed to be, which is unfortunate because I think this album could have been at least good. It could have been at least as good as Eternal Idol, or at least as good as a Seventh Star. But in the end, yes, I would have to say this is absolutely and 100% the worst Black Sabbath record I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think I can't really disagree with that.
So when you say spin it or bin it, oh yeah, it bin this one. I mean, you're going to get 15 minutes of really amazing Iommi solos over the course of a 45-minute bad record.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, man. Well, that's about all I've got with this one.
That's all I've got. So we will, this week, we're going to leave you with the new single from Heavy Feather, Mountain of Sugar. Till next week, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Please rate and subscribe if you can.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Here's the tagline I haven't written. See ya.
Yes, I'm relentless. Mountain of Sugar.